Accession number 1962503.
Well, they went over on the 1st of July with the first sweep, first line, and they went over at the first line, part of the first line, and they got mowed down. And when we took this little village, we took over the little village of Bilmantano, the smell was to high heaven, because all these bodies had been laid there 7 days. We got down about 7th of July, 8th of July. They've been laid there since the 1st of July, and the sun was pouring up, and it can be hot in the pants at 90 degrees.
They're still lying on the surface.
Still lying unburied, yeah. Most of them. And we buried them. Well, we couldn't stop. The smell was so shocking that we said we either want to withdraw in our permission to bury these dead. So we got permission to bury the dead. I told them all Sheffield lads, and we were Sheffield fellows. So we buried these dead, we were pushing 4 or 5 in a shallow. All we did, we just took the tables out of the vest pocket. There was one place you've got to see the table, that's here.
Yeah.
And everybody, you know, it's a book for everybody's table, because in the table book is who they are, where they come from. Open country. There was fields on each side of the road, and they were all churned up with gunfire, shell holes all over the place. Mm. And in one field at this side were some old trenches, very old trenches. And in this lorry, the driver was killed in the lorry. And this lorry was turned upside down, and there were shells all over the roadway. And there's me, and I think another fella was wounded. Me and we wounded, and we were sat in the ditch at the side of the road. And some stretcher bearers came up with an ambulance. And I said, "How did you know we were ill, sir?" He said, "Any wounded?" I said, "Yes, me and this fellow." "Yeah," I said, "you know, we're looking to all the others," I said, "because they're all dead." So he said, "How did you know to come here?" He said, "Well, we've been watching you from that house there, it's a dressing station. The field dressing station, only the troops had gone beyond us, and we hadn't had time to pack up and follow."
"Yeah. Yeah.
And we saw you through some glasses we've got. Anyway," he said, "we'd better take you in, because you can't get in yourself." So I said, "What's the matter with the other fellow that's wounded?" "Let him in." "You're all right, for England." I said, "Thank you very much." So anyway, they carted me on a stretcher and put the other fellow on a stretcher. And when we got to this dressing station, they say, you better not stop here, you better go further down the line to the casualty clearing station," he said. So that was another 10 or 15 miles. So this ambulance, they put us back again in this ambulance, and they took us to this casualty clearing station. And they put him in the next bed to me. And they said, "Who's first?" I said, "Oh, look at me first." And the fellas, they entered. So they sort of me dressing the shrapnel in my knee, that took place on that. And that was a clean all right through the hearing out here.
Mm.
Flesh, right through the flesh, not through the bone. I said, "That's a lucky one. But that would take a bit of healing anyway." It didn't, as it happened. Anyway, so he says, "Can't do anything with you." So he said, "We'll send you down to Boulogne." Eat apples, that's right. He sent us to 23rd General... Boulogne, that was it. 23rd General Hospital at Boulogne. And I think that's who it was at Boulogne, I'm not sure. Whether it was 23rd or 23rd. And we were there a few days, and the doctor came round, looked at me leg, knee. He says, "Can you walk?" I said, "I can if I get a stick."
Mm.
Well, he said, "It's better if you can walk, because you can walk down to the boat." I said, "Am I for England?" He said, "Yes, you're for England." They put a label on me, you know, for England.
Yeah.
Some special label, Red Cross label, stating what was wrong with me. Gunshot wound ankle. And he said, "If you can have them, because we've no would like as many to walk down as can walk down. That's so many really badly wounded.
Yeah.
So the chap next to you, I said, what's the matter with him? He said, not taking him, leaving me. He said, he's my last journey. I said, what's the matter with him? He started talking to the doctor, like, what's the matter with him? He said, didn't you see him when you dressed him this morning? I said, no, I wasn't looking. So he's got a hole in his back as big as the palm of your hand. All the shoulder blades blown away. I said, oh dear. Anyway, they didn't take him. They took me and I got on this rope. But then I got to turned over. And I'd only 10 francs, French francs in his pocket, over. I said, I'll see one of these orders. I thought to myself, and asked him, there were 11 or 12 trains in Dover Station, Red Cross trains, all waiting for the wounded. So I said to one medical order, I said, where's these trains for? He said, all over the country. I says, is there anyone, any train for Sheffield? He said, quite about, yeah. And then I could see that he wanted something. Well, I've only got 10 francs. Will you find out which is for Sheffield? And will you get me on it? He said, do you believe Sheffield? I said, yes. This is the Red Cross Hospital in Sheffield? Well, yes, it's Base Hospital, Collegiate Crescent, Sheffield. I said, the Base Hospital. You know the college at the bottom of the Collegiate Crescent?
Yeah, yeah.
That was the Base Hospital, what they call the Base Hospital.
Yeah.
That's where they sent wounded to come from France. It was a Base Hospital in Northern. I'd like to get there, I said, because I only live not far away in Sheffield. So I gave him the 10 francs. He said, I'll look after you. I said, I should have been on the stretcher, but I said, the surgeon in the hospital says, could I walk? And so I managed to walk. He said, get back on the stretcher. So I said, all right, so I get on this stretcher. It was better to get on the stretcher. So he fetched the nurse. So I said to the nurse, he said to me, this nurse says that train that she's looking after is for Sheffield and District. But she thinks it's the Base Hospital, but she's not quite sure. I said, Sheffield and District will suit me. To be the Base Hospital, the better. So she says, come along then. She says, I'll be Mr. something or other, she called it. And they both got me onto this train, put me stretchered on the train, on the stretcher legs. And the train began to fill up. And I said to this nurse, I said, are you really going to Sheffield? And I said, tell the truth. She said, well, so far as we know, we booked for Sheffield. But, of course, orders can be changed. We don't know about that. But this train should be... She said, you've done Sheffield before, from here. So I said, oh, and she said, you're living in Sheffield after all. I said, yeah. So, well, she said, if there's any change in plans, all that, you know, not that it would be any good, now you're on here. So anyway, it's about 10 o'clock at night then, by then, and we've had some stuff, hot milk and some sandwiches and that. So she comes and she said, well, we're not ready to leave yet, so you better get to sleep. And she said, I'm going to turn the lights low. So she turned the lights low and we all tried to get to sleep. I said, yeah, you know, you'll tell me if there's any change. If I get a chance, she says, I'll tell you. Well, I wake up about 4 in the morning and the train's been up and up, bumpity-bump, bumpity-bump. Couldn't see nothing out of the window. Dark. After all, it's September, it's getting dark earlier. And about 6 in the morning, it's daylight. Look out of the window. All I can see is glass fields. So, well, we've been travelling a long while, so we must have been a long journey. So I see we're running, and I look at the sun and I wonder where I am by the sun, and I can't fathom it out where I am, you know. I'm wondering where the sun rises in the east and it sinks in the west, and it looked to me like as though we were going west. But as nearly I could say, I thought, well, we shouldn't be going west, we should be going north. But anyway, a nurse comes down here, and I said, nurse, I said, where are we going? A different nurse, I said, where are we going? She said, I don't know. She said, you'll see when we get there. You know, a nasty piece of work. I said, you do know, you know, don't you? She She says, I don't know any more than what you know. She says, all I know is that we were going to a certain place and we've been changed for another place. So I knew I was right then when we were going west. Because the sun rises in the east and west is dead opposite, so I knew we were going west. I said, we're going west now. Well, she said, who told you? I said, no, I'm looking at the sunset rising in the east. She said, you're too clever. So anyway, we finish up at St. Leonard's and Hastings on the south coast. So we finish up at Banner Red Cross Hospital on a hillside overlooking St. Leonard's Pier. You can almost see the pier. Anyway, I'm there, and they're still there. So this is September. Well, it takes a lot of healing, this knee and my cap and mine and that. But however, about November 11th, and about beginning of November 1918, I'm walking about now, I'm walking about. So there's a roller skating rink on the pier. So I thought to myself, well, I'd like to try to skirt roller skating, because I've always wanted to roller skate. So I do a bit of roller skating and I keep falling down, so I give it a miss. And about get to about the 8th of November. And I thought myself, well, I'll go and try to roller skate again and got rid of the bruises. So I went and I said to another soldier that was fitting pretty well, do you want to, can you roller skate it? So I said, yeah. I said, well, will you show me how to roller skate? Keep hold of me for a bit until I feel my feet. I had to learn to roller skate. So he said, well, doctor knows you're roller skating and not, he'll take a dim view. So I said, I'm not bothered. I said, I'm almost ready for going home. Anyway, blow me down, I'm trying to roller skate with this fella. And there's a doctor and now a nurse, and they're looking on, and they're laughing my colour at my antics, you know. Kept falling down and picking myself up again. They said, you don't want any more medical attention, I don't think, do you? I said, well, I said, I'm about fit, I couldn't deny it, you know. I've been swinging it a bit, you know, for a day or two. And next morning I get a railway ticket to Sheffield, and 10 days hospital leave, and the railway ticket, and a railway ticket to Hull, for me to join up with the 3rd Reserve Battalion at Hull after my 10 days leave. And I get home the day, November the 10th, I get home. I don't know if his armistice is going to be signed. They're talking about an armistice. I get home November the 10th, and when I wake up in the morning, the armistice is signed and the war is over. And I went out into the streets of Sheffield, and everybody in Sheffield was in the street. Nobody was at home at all. The streets were crowded, and everybody was waving flags and drinking beer. Have a drink, soldier. I could have gotten drunk a dozen times, you know. And that finished the war for me. I mean, I'd had my 10 days leave, and I rejoined at Hull, and I was kept at Hull awaiting the mobilisation, while the following March, from November the 11th, and the following March before I got to demobbed, they were demobbing by trades. First of all, coal miners. Second, steel workers. Third, such and such a workers. And people with different trades, you know. And I had no trade, so I was lost. But I had a brother, you know, who had a little cutlery works down Air Street. And I wondered about him, you know. And one evening on orders, evening orders, every night orders was put on the board, orders for the next day. And it said, such and such a day, March the 2nd. So anybody appertaining to the cutlery trade, report at the order room at once. So I went to the order room, and the first man belonging to the cutlery said, oh, and where do you work? Where did you work before the war? I said, I worked at Air Street, such and such a work. Oh, and can you get your past employee to ask for you? I said, I can't think so. So straight away I got on the phone, went out. I after the camp, got on the phone to my brother Martin to claim me out as one of his crippling workers. You know, work on Marge report. So, which he did essentially sent a letter stating to the commanding officer, the reserve battalion, such and such a camp, and stating that he'd like to claim Leonard Shaw back, that he was one of my best workmen. And straight away I got a ticket for Clipston Camp Mansfield, get on the train, and I got to Clipston Camp Mansfield about 10 o'clock at night. And the train ran right on the side of the demobilisation camp. There was a foot of snow on the ground, and we reported to the order room about 10 o'clock at night. They had us a medical examination. In the snow, take your coat and vest off and your shirt off and drop your trousers. And they, in the stood in the snow, medical examination, they were looking for BD, you know. And then get your clothes on, report to that up there. So we reported to this up, and name, regiment, put it all down. Home address, put it down. What would you like? Suit of clothes, or would you like £2? Fish your bike suit for £2, you know. Would you like £2, or would you like a suit of clothes? If you want a suit of clothes, we'll measure. If you want £2, here's £2 and go. So I said, I'll take £2, I've got three or four suits in up in my wardrobe. So I took £2 and I went. Out into the cold, cold store. Oh, give me a ticket for Sheffield. The platform so and so. Sheffield in about an hour's time. So I got outside this hut and I'm walking towards the railway station to railway platform, and I see another fella that I know from Sheffield coming in back. So I said, what are you coming back for, Joe? He left something. No, he says, I've got £2 easy just now. What do you want to sort of yours for £2? So I said, I'm going back with another £2. I said, why? This is not asking you for any identification, or they ask you your name, your number. Which will you want, £2 or a suit of clothes? And I said, £2, will you give me £2 and tell me to get up? I said, better take your name and address down and everything. He says, you don't have to give them your name and address. Don't have to give them the right one, do you? You don't have to give them the right name. They don't ask you for your pay book. I said, no, you're right there. I said, but I don't want any of it, thank you very much. I said, now I'm out of the army. I said, that's all I want. Well, she said, I'm going back. And he went back, and I waited for him, and he came out with £2 again. And the fellow at Yimmer, £2, said, you've been here before, you better not come again. How did he know? I said, all he's under the men. I said, well, I suppose he's got used to it. I said, I'm very glad I didn't go. I said, because if the two of us went, we'd have got pulled up. But I didn't want any, all I wanted I was out.
Yeah.
And I was out. That's the story of the Great War.
Well, I just could ask you one or two general questions about certain things. You said you joined up with some friends, or you had some friends of yours.
You want to know what happened to the friends?
Well, generally, if I have, yeah, I think
we've never really got... Only two of us went out to France. Only two of us soldiers. One of my friends deserted from walking. When we got down to walking in Selby, the first 2 or 3 weeks of our journey, we got to walking in Selby.
Yeah.
And he went to London and under 48 hours leave. He asked for leave for London for 48 hours to visit a relation. And he never came back anymore. He simply deserted.
Did they find him?
Never. He went to America. I got a letter from America, which had followed me from Whitley Camp, from this camp at Walking.
Okay.
Hinkleman Barracks, Walking. This letter followed me to Salisbury Plain, and it was from this chap, Mr. So-and-so, and he wrote to say that he got a boat to Ireland from Liverpool, and from Queenstown in Ireland he got a boat to New York, and he was in New York. And the other one, when we got to Selly, he fought at 6, and the aliens discharged from the army with an alien disease.
Yeah.
They didn't keep him in the army and cure him like they did later on.
Yeah.
They simply gave him a ticket, discharged. He got discharged, came back to Sheffield. That's what happened to him. Now the third one went out to France with us, and we were their friends. A fellow called Frank Barnes, a dead man butcher. And when we were at Armentières, as early as that in the war, that was the first time we went in the trenches, Armentières. And when we got to Armentières, word came round, is there anybody in your platoon, to our officer, that's worked in a steelworks? And he said, yes, Frank Barnes said, yes, I've worked in a steelworks. They asked him where he worked. He said, I worked at Spill, Jackson's, Saddle Street, Sheffield. Well, report at the order room and you're for home. All steel workers are for home. Steel workers have no right to join up, like colliers have no right to join up. And he got his discharge immediately to go and work at Spill and Jackson's in his old job. And he went to Spill and Jackson's and never saw him well after the war. After the war, I met him again, and of course.
So they all survived. I was just wondering if casualty figures that you found.
Amongst my friends, well, most of my main friends, I mean, I can tell you casualty figures. I don't suppose that there was one man left in all my platoon that really travelled the war with me.
Mm.
I'll show you a picture of the platoon. I'll show you what the platoon looks like. I don't think any of these boys that's on this picture, I don't remember any of them travelling the whole war with me. It may have been, but I doubt it very, very much. Here's when the picture was taken, and I told you when. 7th Kings on York's line, 1914, 15, 16, 17. Oh, it was taken when I was a sergeant. Oh, no, it wasn't. It was when I was a private. Anyway, that's all about when they were taken, but that's the picture, and that's me with the arrow over the top.
Yeah.
A bit thinner now. And those are all more or less Sheffield and District youth. On the back it tells you when it was taken, I think. When it was taken in 1900. Oh, Salisbury Plains, I think.
Yes, it's Salisbury Plain. Lightful. Yeah.
Now that's ticket. About 60 men on there, which has consisted of one platoon.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier about being no morale by about, well, soon into the war.
I had been knocked out of it.
I've read that, I mentioned earlier that the French suffered in late 1917, early 1918, a lot of mutinies, and men refusing to fight.
They were mutinies, they had a kind of caution.
Yeah. But this didn't happen, you didn't have a lot of disobedience.
Oh, no.
But did you ever remember being shot for mutiny or desertion?
No, I never remember a case of being shot for it. I never remember that. Anybody from our battalion deserted.
What kept people in the line?
Could you desert to?
It was just, you got to a stage where you thought, well, if this is the end, this is the end. There's nothing I can do about it.
Whatever the old morale, nobody, to my knowledge, ever deserted from the line, or ever deserted from ours. I tell you what, we did have troops deserting when they went home on leave.
Yeah.
Not return.
Yeah.
We had some of that. In fact, I was tempted myself once. I got a 10 days leave, and I came home, and I debated whether to go to Liverpool and get a boat to. The best way of deserting was to get a boat to Ireland, which was, if you get a boat to Ireland without anything, just stay up there and off you go. As simple as that. And when you got to Dublin or Ireland, you could go anywhere in the world. Passports weren't known in those days.
Yeah.
And that's one that deserted, as I tell you.
Yeah.
He said he wrote to me that he just went to Liverpool and got a boat to Dublin. And from Dublin he went to Queenstown and got a boat to Queenstown probably, or Cork, or some seaside place. And he got a boat from Queenstown, he said to New York without any trouble.
So
I don't know of anybody deserting in the line while I was soldier.
I suppose it's very difficult to get away from the line anyway.
Well, it's difficult to get away from the line because if you're in the front line, behind you, you've got the reserve trenches. And besides that, there's the second reserve trenches, very often was occupied. And then behind that, you get divisions, brigade headquarters and divisional headquarters. And on almost all the streets, the road corners of crossroads, you found a red cap.
Yeah.
Red cap was a police, an army police.
Yeah.
And you found a red cap at a lot of street corners. And if you were wandering about loose in any town or village behind the line, you're bound to get picked up.
Did you hear of, I mean, was it common knowledge that people were severely punished for...
I only once saw in orders that a certain private of such and such a regiment, I wouldn't remember it, had been shot for deserting the lines, deserting from the front lines. I only heard of one, and it's only just one that comes back to my mind.
Mm.
There may have been more.
Yeah, because I was reading about a year ago in a magazine, they were saying that there were about 250 British soldiers shot, executed, for mutiny, or during the whole period of the war, and at different points on the line. And they were suggesting that the fact that people were aware that you could be shot was enough to sort of keep people from attempting to desert.
There's possibility about that, but I don't think there's that number.
But you never came across more than that, just one?
I only saw once in orders that a man had been shot deserting his force. By the same rule, I could have got a man shot myself if I had wanted, because sleeping while he was on a serious force. As a matter of fact, it was a place called Mealy Mealy, and I mentioned it before in there.
Yeah.
And I was a corporal at the time, and I was in charge of some Lewis gunners, as I remarked to you before.
Yeah.
I was in charge of some machine gunners, and I got one in a little fort, away from the dugouts and the trenches. There was a little fort. A round ring of a trench in a round ring, and with a Lewis gun mounted for the airplane. The Germans were coming with these flimsy airplanes.
Yeah.
We've got a few of these flimsy, just sticks and stones, sticks and that.
Yeah.
You know what an old type airplane was? A lot of sticks like props.
Yeah.
Close props. That's all they look like. With a little engine, no bigger than a motorcycle engine. And they used to fly over about 100 yards up or 100 foot up. And sometimes if you were a bit lucky, you could bring one down with your Lewis gun, with a machine gun. Or even if you were being known to bring one down with one rifle shot, if you hit the engine in its vital part.
Yeah.
Well, we'd be in trouble with these German aeroplanes. Not dropping bombs, but just firing at us as they came over.
Mm.
Not with a machine gun, firing at us with revolvers or... used to come very low, because that was flying in those days.
Mm.
Before they could go any very high, they could go maybe 100 yards up and that's all.
Mm.
And they were very flimsy. They were the right sort of aeroplane.
Yeah.
And they used to fire at them with revolvers. Well, we had to fire at them with Lewis guns. That was all horn rifles. And he came over very low, this fellow, this German. And when I shout, "Gunner, gunner!" No reply, and when I went down to this little fort, down the train, he's fast asleep. Beside this gun, this Lewis gun, and he's fast asleep, this fella. A Polish chap called Lap something, Lebovich, some name like that. He wasn't a shepherd fella, he was coming from. I think he came from Liverpool, and I wasn't sure about it. He'd been a seaman at sea. Mm. And there was a Polish chap who could hardly speak. I don't know how he got into the British Army to be local. And I woke him up and said, "Hey," I said, "what are you in the fleet for?" I said, "they'll get you shot for this, to sleep on your post." It's not even always been down the aeroplane, just a number higher than your 20 foot, 20 to 30 feet up. If I'd had your wish, then I could have shot him down. So he apologised and said he was sorry and that, and the police was already down his face. So I didn't take any notice. I mean, I didn't report him. So then I wouldn't do a report at all. To get him into serious trouble. So I said, well, I said, keep your eyes open. I said, if he comes again, let him have it. Well, to cut a long story short, somebody must have hit him, because they were all firing at him with the rifle, because he came over about 10 minutes later and started firing. I think it was a revolver shot. It was of no importance, because the time they reached the ground, they wouldn't have any velocity. You know, and somebody must have hit this fellow, because he came down in the field just about 100 yards away. He wasn't killed. He came down, a proper gentle glide down, and he